Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us so early this morning. My name is Chelsea Wadigo. I'm a Manjali and South Island woman and as a visitor to this place. I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting on the lands of the Kulin Nation, and in particular I want to acknowledge the unceded sovereignty of the Wurundjeri, Wurrung people, and pay my respects to all the mob in the room today. This panel, ambitiously un-Australian, is a kind of selfish panel for me. I wanted to be in conversation with three people that I really admire, both their work and in their being, in terms of embodying this idea in really powerful, powerful ways. So I want to introduce you to our panelists. We have, of course, Tarneen Onus-Williams, who is a proud Gutjamara Bindal Yorta Yorta person and Torres Strait Islander from Mer and Arab Islands. Tarneen is a community organiser for Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance and has written for and been published in Indigenous X, the Saturday Paper, NITV and Right Now. And Tarneen's day job is working in community legal education at BALS. Amanda Porter is from the Brinjer clan of the Yuin Nation and grew up in a police community called Warren. She is a police scientist, prison abolitionist and police accountability lawyer. And she has worked pro bono for community organisations, including the Warriors of Aboriginal Resistance, Kinchilla Boys Home, Naja and Pomperau Committee, among many others. And last but not least, Michaela Saunders, who is a Koori Guri and Lebanese writer, teacher, community researcher and the editor of This All Come Back to Me Now, Come Back Now, the world's first anthology of blackfella speculative fiction. And I also want to congratulate Michaela for being the winner of the David Unipin Award at the Queensland Literary Awards just this week. Please welcome our panellists. Now, I thought that we couldn't get into this conversation without first acknowledging this current moment of the passing of the Queen. And it's been an interesting kind of conversation at the moment. And I thought I'd give you each the opportunity to reflect on where you're at. Are you okay? How are you feeling?
Well, yeah, I guess a bit sleepless, to be honest, but a bit tired, because I went to sleep really late on Thursday night, waiting for the moment. But then I was like, no, I need to drive like 5 or 6 hours tomorrow, so I need to go to bed. But I was waking up nearly every hour, checking the news. and then
you were waiting in anticipation.
Anticipation.
Bless.
Yes. So what it happened? I woke up at 4:30, went to the bathroom. I was like, nah, surely it's not happened yet. I'm not going to skip this hour. Jump back into bed, and I was like, actually, no, I am going to check. And then it had happened, and I called my mum 4 times, and she didn't answer.
What was she doing?
And then I called my brother, because my brother lives with her, and I realised he was in the hospital, so he was not with her. So then I called my mum again, and then she answered, and I was like, Mum, the Queen's dead! And she said, Tane, I know, I've been up watching the news. And so I sat up with her for 2 hours watching the news, and she just said to me, like, we're watching the same channel, and she was in Melbourne and I was in Gippsland, and she said to me, yeah, the longest reigning thief. So it was very, like, it was a very funny morning yesterday, and I got to have a celebratory drink with Annie Ronnie Gorry on the way back. And, yeah, we had our juice and our smoothie and did a little cheers on yesterday morning. So, look, it's, I think it's, yeah, it's funny. I'm also trying to cash in on the moment. So I went to the bank yesterday, made sure I went to the Stolen Wealth Bank to get some coins because, you know, we'll change currency soon as well. And I thought maybe if I hold the coins for 50 years, they might be worth something. May as well cash on the Queen. So there's been a lot of thought about this. But yeah, I think it's, yeah, it's just, I think it's a weird moment to be here and to, when a monarch dies, and to see us blackfellas and also Irish Twitter going off
about
it, and just enjoying the moment that this monarch who's represented so much dispossession and violence and erasure to our peoples. And I think that, you know, it feels like accountability, you know? So, yeah.
I feel like I haven't given enough thought. I've just been sharing memes on my Insta stories.
Me and Mum have been preparing. I was messaging people, London Bridge is falling. So, yeah, it's been in there in the works.
And then have you been watching Twitter and some of the responses, or have you experienced this moment? Sorry,
I can't follow that. I'm not anywhere near as funny. And I'll be a Debbie Downer on it. I guess I've been following just that convergence of Blackfella Twitter and Irish Twitter, and that's been giving some reprieve. But I've been pretty busy working this whole week and the last 2 weeks with you, Chelsea, on the writing a report for the coronial inquest into the death of Kumanjai Walker, and I'm not allowed to talk about that.
No, we aren't.
I just wanted to flag this because and I thought it was funny when Chelsea asked me to come to speak at the Writers' Festival, and I think one of the things that I'll probably, a theme I'll return to, is just that I am muzzled, and there are things that I can't say that I desperately do want to tell you, that I desperately do want to write down, and there's, research, op-eds, things that just won't be published. And I guess I'll be talking about the opposite, about not being a writer, but about not being able to get stuff out there and the challenges I've faced in trying to get my truth out there. But because I've been so immersed in that, I think the reflection that I had about the Queen's death was more just the utter bizarreness of the situation that we're going to have. You know, I saw the weekend, edition, and that we have this reaction of the Australian corporate media. We'll have 15 more days of this. And it reminds me of, around about May last year, when there was the 30-year anniversary of the tabling in Parliament of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and there was a massive rally that was organised by Tarneen and others at the time, and barely made a blip in the Australian corporate media. Instead, they were running stories about Philip. It was the same thing. That was just they were the overwhelming headlines. That was the story that was deemed to be the most newsworthy. And I think that speaks volumes about what Australia values and doesn't value.
Absolutely.
Yep, I agree. I've found it funny, I'm only human. I've found it's funny because it's not even just like Blackfella Twitter or Irish Twitter, it's like all colonised Twitter, kind of rising up and like sharing these jokes and these similar experiences. And it just goes to show how far-reaching this evil empire has been and still is. And it's been funny watching people get angry at people making jokes, that backlash. It's such a, even policing our joy and our reactions and our ways of, it is... sometimes people die, often people die, always people die, we all are going to die. But when it's someone who represents so much violence and oppression and theft and just all the horrible shit that's been keeping us down for so long, it's a nice feeling. But then again, I think she's just going to be replaced by someone else. So, so it's not like she dies and the whole system falls. So, but we can have a little joy, can't we?
Absolutely. We'd like to think we could have some joy. And I think just, I hear you, Amanda, when you're talking about, like, in the midst of this moment of what seems like joy is that Blackfellas are, in this current moment, in active fights against the violence of the state and settler colonialism and even fighting to have the story told about systemic racism in the preventable deaths of our mob. In this time, so that joy comes from a place of anger, pain and love for Blackfellas. Should be read in that context, you would hope, but fuck hope. I wanted to talk now to some... Because I selfishly, there are moments in each of your work that made me think about a conversation I wanted to have with each of you, and this is not a spectacle of black trauma, although in the course of being ambitiously un-Australian, there's a whole lot of violence that gets visited upon us in that. And so I find it really interesting, it was sort of the 90s around Howard Hanson, where suddenly this idea of being un-Australian sort of came into popular discourse, and anything sort of bad, morally bad, was deemed un-Australian, which was kind of funny given this place. And so there's this whole thing about sort of being un-Australian as a bad thing. And we're celebrating it today as a fucking good thing. But I want to talk to Tanine, take you back to 2018, Invasion Day. I think it was Burn, Hope It, what was the line? I hope it burns to the ground.
Burn it to the ground.
Oh, yeah, I think I said
immortal words.
Oh, it was like, I hope, fuck Australia, I hope burns to the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the line.
And so when I saw that moment, I was like just so in awe of your power and strength and staunchness. Like, it was like, yeah, like, I want to be like that, you know? And it was hearing you speak at Black and Bright early this year. What struck me is in the joy that that moment gave me was hearing the absolute violence that was visited upon you that few knew personally, you know, about, and you spoke so generously and intimately about what was going on at that time. And I don't mean to have to, like, bear your wounds and revisit all of that, but I'm curious about what it has taught you about the price it is paid to be ambitiously un-Australian and kind of how you look at that time now.
Yeah, I guess, like, after that moment, it... I didn't really get what had happened. I guess when those things happen and, like, you end up on the newspapers and TV, you just don't really know the gravity of it until either, like, a few months later or years later that there's that time of reflection. but, yeah, there was, like, lots of death threats. Well, it's still death threats. And, you know, it's about the toll that it takes is that it's all, I'm always so vigilant. I remember, like, after organising the Black Lives Matter protest, like, someone wrote a death threat to a radio host at Triple R, signed with my name. And...
Oh, wow.
And it was with an address that was, like, a couple of streets away from me. So I thought, oh, this person must know that I live around this in this area and they've written this letter to this person. Luckily, the radio host and I had a mutual, my cousin, but and so my cousin messaged me and was like, oh, did you write a death threat to this person? And I was like, I have no idea who this person is. First of all, and, like, you know, the person was going to go to the police because I'd written a death threat. So it's just, like, there's those, but then there's, like, the ones that are directed at me. But after, you know, after a month, I reckon, after the burnt down comment, I was feeling, like, depressed and defeated. And I saw my therapist and he'd seen it all through the media. He was like, oh, you know, I was waiting for you to give me a call.
Right.
And I was thinking, lad, you could have called me. and we spoke about it and he said to me, you know, do any of those people's, like, you know, that are saying that to you, do you, like, what are their values? And I was like, well, they're white supremacists, they are all of these things. He was like, okay, and have you ever cared about those people before? No. He was like, well, why do you care about them now? These people don't know you, that you don't value them, their opinions or what they say, so why are you going to do that now?
And what's your answer to that?
And I said, you know what, you're absolutely right, because I just thought, why do I let these people affect who I am, especially, like, what I'm doing particularly and how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
And it meant that I was able to go move through the world really unapologetically about it, still being cautious of the way that I move through the world in a way that's, like, in safety, but not afraid of, you know, like, what can happen, I guess, and more... I had my back more and I believed in myself more. And so, you know, it was yeah, I think that was like really important for me to have that, because like, you know, when that happened, my workplace was like treating me really badly, and obviously the media was like shit, but I had like my family and my community backing me.
Yeah.
And that was what mattered. So I had to count the people that were there for me.
Yeah.
And it was people who were also ambitiously un-Australian. So that was really important. And, you know, the love that we have as black followers and for each other and the generosity that we show is the thing that got me through.
But that having your own back more.
Yeah.
Yeah, bless.
Yeah.
Thank you. Amanda, I had a couple of moments that I wanted to yarn you about just to set the scene for this, particularly as a black academic working in this place and trying to bring an evidence base to the reality of violence here and your work in criminology. There's a couple of moments, and I'll let you decide where you want to go with this, but there was a moment, and we were both in conversation publicly around this one, and this was in response to that scholarly work that kind of what I felt pathologised black crime here in this place in an intellectual way. And then there was also the fun conversations with the carceral feminists around coercive control, or as you like to call them, criminology Karens. And I just was so related to what you were going through, but I'm keen for you to tell us, for those who aren't familiar with what went down during these conversations. Are you able to sort of set the scene?
Yeah,
for us on that?
It's I'm not popular with Australasian criminologists. That's the shorter gist of the story. And there's a few kind of stories I could kind of focus in on. Before I did, I just wanted to thank Tarnine, because I think when this shit hit the fan, and it hit the fan multiple times last year, and I was the subject of a number of attacks in the corporate media by Corey Bernardi and Andrew Bolt and all these other lovely people. An entertainment writer wrote this lovely number.
An entertainment writer, yeah. For goodness sake.
complaints, multiple complaints to my dean. I don't usually call people Karen unless there was a descriptive moment in that. That's actually, if you put in a complaint to your dean, that is, you know, what literally kind of just descriptively what was happening. Lots of hate mail and rude emails and just making the mistake of reading the comments, that kind of stuff. But when shit hit the fan really bad at that time, Tarnine rocked up to my house and took me out to dinner. And I just want to say how, and with Dr. Crystal McKinnon, it meant the world to me at the time. And it was a real, really, really rough day. But I'll never forget that support and care and the thoughtfulness. I appreciate it. But yeah, it's a long yarn, but for context, I've got nothing against individual criminologists. It's just that
I do.
It's just that I did serve on a couple of the major criminology journals, the Current Issues in Criminal Justice and the Australian New Zealand Journal of Criminology. I don't know why, but I did for a time serve on both those journals, and I read a lot of shit. You know, I just couldn't believe the kind of, and there were certain tropes that kind of certain types of articles that it's very easy to get published in Australasian journals, and I got so tired of this that eventually, after you know a couple of years, I resigned from both journals, and I wrote up my experiences in a satirical journal, in a fake journal called the Journal of Aussie Criminology, and it's on my academia page if you want to have a look. It's meant to be funny. It's meant to be taking
it's hilarious.
It's taking the piss out of the kind of articles that get through this so-called academic double-blind peer review process. Yeah. Anyway, but I digress. That's the context. And
no, thank you, Amanda. Then, I'm going to read it now.
And then the other important contextual matter is that I don't know if people realise just how much money is spent on prisons and police in this country. In Victoria, you can Google it if you don't believe me. It's $4 billion for this year alone and a promise of $350 police for this year alone. It's surpassing health and education. Imagine what Vowels would do with 350 staff just 1 year. I can't get my mind around it. And so it's nothing personal against these individual criminologists. It's just, I think that it's a naive and, irrational response to be writing articles where, Chelsea mentioned carceral feminist. By that, I think it's strange that, and I will always lock horns with anyone who's going on the public record arguing that the police need more powers. Mm-hmm. And I say, go back and do the readings. Do you have any idea how many, the police have incredible powers in this country already, incredible powers. People arguing that police need more resources, that we need, that the police need a bigger budget. I'm I just can't comprehend the point that they're coming from. And I also dispute their kind of, and often arguing for more exotic carceral things that might look exotic because they're from another country or something, like women's police stations or something. But if you scratch below the surface, things aren't what they seem. And, my issue is not personal, it's methodological. And my critique of all of these articles is also I fought to get these on the public record. It's really hard when, for example, as was the case with an argument I had with Professor Kerry Carrington, who is a proponent for women's police stations. It's based on a research article that I think has a lot of confirmation bias. It's based on a study where, they got two ARC grants, I should add. So this is hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to do this, incredibly flawed study, and this is just, one example. As I said to Chelsea, we're spoilt for choice. I could go on forever, but I'll try and wrap it up. Just suffice to say that it was a study, a well-funded study. They went overseas. They were shepherded around by the Department of Justice, so that itself lends a bias, especially if they have to sign a deed or an agreement to do that. But fatally, didn't interview any survivors of domestic violence, didn't interview any people in the town in which the police stations were located. Who did they interview? 100% employees of that institution. So of course they're going to say these things are spectacular and great, and they put roses up and paintings and it's the panacea to DV. Sure enough, we get this academic thing rejoined and published, and it was hard too. That took us nearly a year to get out because Kerry Carrington runs one of the three major journals. Her PhD candidate is the editor of the other journal. You see what I mean? And then the Australian Journal of the other journal, they hate my guts because I publicly eviscerated them. They never publish my stuff. They hate me. Anyway,
that's got your own journal now.
I believe you have your own Australian New Zealand Society of Silly Racist Studies. Is that your current handle?
And that was the... That was one of the complaints that I received to my dean. It was Kerry Carrington actually made this 65-page complaint and screenshotting all of my tweets that I've ever done that she claimed were defamatory and that she was intending to sue me for. And it did. The complaint went through legal within the law school. It went through... she demanded that I change my Twitter handle because she found it offensive as a member of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology. And I think I've called it the ANZ Society of White Groupthink Studies. And that's the complaint of my, that's what I'm doing in the journal, right? Because it's like, I'm not, and again, it's just descriptive. They are only non-Indigenous people on the editorial board. Mm. And so, therefore, all of this stuff regularly gets published that's really, doesn't pass muster.
Were you surprised at, and this is probably a dodgy question, but surprised at the way in which people came for you by participating in public discourse as a scholar, critiquing the work methodologically. Mm. Were you surprised at the way in which, like, you, this idea that you couldn't be a public intellectual, or you didn't have the right to academic freedom? Because that still surprises me.
But it surprised me coming from the academics, especially, like, that Kerry's response, Professor Carrington's response, was, and others, the other editors of the ANZ SOC and the previous, you know, even the people who were previously the editors of the journal, kind of, were just, you know. They were so angry at me. They were livid. And what I don't understand is that, you know, I think the tweet that was so-called defamatory, I literally said, I said to Jess Hill, who's a carceral feminist as well.
I love that you're naming them all here.
Sorry. I just mean in the sense that she's an advocate. Let me rephrase that. Jess Hill is a proponent for Professor Carrington's work and for the idea, the proposal of women's only police stations as a solution to domestic violence. I'll try to avoid using labels. I just asked Jess if she could point to some evidence for this proposal works. And she pointed to this article by Kerry Carrington, and I said, yes, that's one methodologically flawed article. And that was the tweet that was so offensive. And as I said, you know, at the time to my dean and on in response, I mean, you know, isn't that just the bread and butter of academic work? Isn't that what you're meant to do, to argue about, you know, competing truth claims and rigor of a methodological study? Like, that's just it's nothing against her personally. It's nothing against the other people, doctors Shepherd and Spivak. It's nothing. It's just that I think that their work is flawed. That's all.
Yeah,
and fragile too because of the response. Hey, incredibly fragile response.
Yeah,
critique is. It makes things stronger.
Yeah. That's what I think. I think it's like, surely we can participate in this conversation.
Did you grow up in an argumentative family?
What's that?
Did you grow up in an argumentative family?
We used to argue over the newspaper in the morning, me and Dad over the Courier Mail. We would debate everything. Yeah. Bless. Michaela, you've been forging a space in the creative space and particularly laying claim to black spec fiction and claiming a future that has been denied us.
Yes.
Can you tell us about the anthology and also the response to your very public critique of the space?
Yeah, well, I haven't got death threats or like defamation stuff, so I don't think I'm doing.
I'm sure
enough.
It's coming. So.
But I've still got time.
It's only a matter.
I'm
of
a
time.
Blowing. So I added this beautiful anthology, which came out a few months ago, called This All Come Back Now, and I put it together because I have been studying speculative fiction. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, it's a kind of big porous basket that holds all the stories together that kind of swim in and out of a consensus reality. And it's a contested term because for blackfellas, a lot of our stories aren't speculative or fake or fantasy. When we talk about ghost stories and horror stories and things like that, these are part of our worldviews and our realities and how we experience life. Nevertheless, it is a Western term, speculative fiction. So ghost stories, horror stories, futurism, science fiction, fantasy, all the, like, for me, the most interesting kinds of stories. And I've been studying it the last few years because it all started with Mad Max, okay? It all started with Mad Max. I was watching Mad Max in, like, 2016 for the millionth time, and I realised that in all of the movies, in all of the four movies, there was only one Aboriginal character. Now, there are characters who play at Aborigine, they play at being native, but they're not Aboriginal. There's only one Aboriginal character and he's dead, he's a ghost. Mm. And he accuses Mad Max in a dream, he says, "You let us die." And to me, that is the most apt metaphor for our representation in post-apocalyptic Australia. Mm. I sought out and I read so many versions of Australian futurism that included us. Most of them didn't include us. They genocided us. But the ones that did include us were in these kind of oppressed and last of their race type of ways. And I was just sick of it. And I decided I wanted to start writing my own speculative fiction. And actually, the manuscript that got that won the David Yonah Pond, it's called Always Will Be. And it's an assertion of sovereignty. All of the stories in this manuscript are set in my community in the Tweed in the future, but in different versions of the future, different climate scenarios, political structures, and they all centre and celebrate my community or Aboriginal people as a community, not just as lone or token blackfellas. Because I wanted our young people, but even our old people who like these stories, to see us thriving in these futures and not extinct and not genocided and not, you know, downtrodden and poor. Because a lot, you know, yes, a lot of white specfic writers have done this over, you know, the 100 years or so they've been writing about us. But, you know, even some Aboriginal writers are guilty of this. And so I wanted to kind of speak back against that. As we were talking about, critique is a really healthy thing. I sought out every single Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander speculative fiction story I could, and I read them and I studied them. And because I wanted my work to be in conversation with them, I didn't want to pretend I was the first or the best to do this. I wanted to see what our other writers had been doing. From 1990, when our first speculative fiction novel was published by Uncle Sam Watson, who was a very staunch Murray activist and author, he published The Kadaitcha Sung in 1990, and it's such a weird novel, and it's set in Brisbane and Fingal, and yeah, just very weird. And I wanted, in this anthology, we included an excerpt of Sam's work in here, and we also we put in other seminal works from Alexis Wright, Archie Weller, who also wrote a futurist novel in the 90s, because I wanted to, I knew this was going to be a world first, and I wanted it to respect the people who had been doing it, you know, before. I didn't want to pretend that it was all just new and young people doing it. I wanted it to be a community. You know, coming to the theme of being ambitiously un-Australian, you know, we come from people who survived attempted genocide. And so it's very important. It's important for everyone to see their people in the future, but for us it's especially important, mm-hmm. you know, and especially queer blackfellas because, you know, our rates of, you know, suicide and all that, it's just so much more dire. So a lot of my stories are very queer and I hope that by reading them, young blackfellas, queer blackfellas can see ourselves and so that, you know, because I grew up not seeing that and thinking, you know, why aren't we there? Yeah, but yeah, and more and more people are writing us into the future in these ways, which is great. Yeah.
I always remember the call from Auntie Dr. Lilla Watson, who said we have to imagine a future as far ahead of us as the past behind us.
Yes.
Mm. That task is not an easy one because we're still fighting in the present just to be seen. Mm. I'm curious just to, I guess I open this up, is to get you, I wonder about, how it is you experience this process of writing that's always caught up in this fight to be seen as belonging to the category of human in the place in which we became human in. And you get tired of having to do that.
I'm a naturally combative person. I got five brothers, you know. We were always fighting and ragging on each other, so I find it pretty natural. I love writing and I write a lot of fiction, but I do write a lot of essays as well, and I love that style. I love that I can be direct and I don't have to think about character and setting. I can just be really blunt and explore issues and explore my own mind through it. It gets tiring in certain ways. I don't write a lot of memoir or life writing. I'm a pretty private person. But every time I have, it has taken its toll. I wrote an essay for Sydney Review of Books a few weeks ago, and it's called Stories of Our Dysfunction Have Been Greatly Exaggerated. And I talk about, the role the media have played in storying us as dysfunctional degenerates, where, in, you know, In fact, it has been the Australian state who have been very degenerate towards us and enacting violence on us, but that violence never gets acknowledged. And that was hard because it did draw on, you know, personal and family experiences of domestic violence. I came to hate writing it. I felt I was in a foul mood every time I worked on it. And, yeah, so I know it's hard. I don't do it a lot. And so I respect, you know, I read your book, Chelsea, and I can imagine how hard it would have been to write some of those things out. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, like, oftentimes, we're, you know, writing for the sake of fighting, we can get cast in a particular light, and I always get the whole people have read the book and go, oh, you seem really angry. I think about Tanine with your public presence and then your writing. There's a real humility and vulnerability in the op-eds that I've read that you've written. Mm. And I just, like, I'm just curious about how that process of the you know, the public expression and in, you know, speaking and writing and what place you're in when you write?
Yeah, it's weird thinking about how people perceive you and then, like, who you are. I didn't really think about it until a couple of years ago. When I was, like, I was doing a doco, filming a doco, and they were filming me at a protest and then they did, like, an interview after and they were like, oh, you're like a completely different person. Like, yeah, because that's how I'm organising, like, trying to organise 50,000 people to walk down the street. Like, it's, you know,
yeah,
hard work, to say the least. But, yeah, I think that when I do write, I do write a lot of stories and I try to bring it back to, like, my experience and my family's experience and... I think that, I guess one thing is that I grew up religious, so I think that, you know, you learn to be vulnerable quite a lot because you're with the Lord or whatever. Like, I'm not really religious anymore, but I think that it does, like, you know, it has stuck around that the part of being vulnerable and, like, sharing that with people, but also learning about abolition and... like talking when you're talking about vulnerability and you want to share that with people, it's about you know, people, and when you be vulnerable with people, it you're giving them a gift as well.
Absolutely.
And it gives people a chance to, like, love you and care for you or, like, understand you in particular ways. I think when I've the grief piece that I did, Grief is Weird, I wrote that knowing that my mum and my cousins and my best friends and, like, all of that, those people were going to be in the room. So I wrote it to them, and it was because I wanted them to know that I loved them and that I've really honoured the moments that we had together when those moments were really hard. So I think that's, you know, part of why when I do write, it is vulnerable because I have those people in my mind and I want to share the experiences of my loved ones through the writing and want them to hear the stories and because I value them so much, yeah.
That grief one just wrecked me but gave me so much joy too. And it was just the way in which you were able to bring that together and you felt your loyalty to the black audience that you were honouring, including family, but all of us that were there. Amanda, I want to come back to, I guess, a point you talked about in that moment of dealing with the violence of criminology in the academy and, you know, having dinner with Tanine and Crystal and having that support. I'm curious, when you're always in this task of fighting, even with an evidence base, bringing your intellectual tools to the table, you know, I think people think that when you're critical, they don't realise that we're often most critical of ourselves before we even step out to publicly critique something. Like, we all check ourselves. I'm really curious, for my own selfish purposes, what do you do with the darkness and doubt in the midst of that stuff, if I can ask?
I don't know if I've got any strategies for that except for, I guess, because of my work. I just want to say how beautiful that was, Tanine, what you're saying, but I don't, to be honest, like I was saying earlier, like it's not just the academic work that I have trouble getting out. Also, because I'm doing police accountability work and coronial inquests, I'm just, it's important that people understand that what's on the public record is so biased and so heavily controlled in terms of suppression orders, in terms of non-publication orders, in terms of contempt of court, things you can and can't say. It means that, you know, these inquests or commissions of inquiry just, in my view, delaying tactics that mean that we've hold the truth from the public. And I struggle a great deal because I have that, I've seen the brief of evidence, these briefs of evidence, I've seen, if to do the work that I do, I have to do freedom of information requests, like GIPA stuff, you know, casework or, you know, just seeing the brief of evidence, but holding on to that material, like I'm not going to lie, I end up in hospital. I'm hospitalised quite regularly for chronic insomnia because I can't put it out there because I can't talk to many people about it. And, you know, and it's really crazy for me because I'm reading these briefs about, you know, deaths in custody where, you know, the next day the police are having barbecues, like, you know, multiple. And we saw that with, you know, going all the way back to Sergeant Hurley, you know, barbecue the next day. They're all sleeping fine. I'm the one that, just, yeah.
And what's, I think, just, you know, the irony here is that when you do enter into those spaces where you're permitted to, you know, contribute to public discussions, it's you that gets cast as the perpetrator, as the threat to be contained.
Yep.
And so your body's bearing witness to all of this violence in ways the public don't know.
Yeah.
Because those late nights reading through the evidence. And then when you get cast as the perpetrator, just how do you reconcile that?
I can't make sense of it, if I'm honest. Like, I mean, it's just it just feels very lonely, and that's a feeling that I have at work, for example. Like, probably have 5 friends who I can count on one hand, one of whom's here. Shout out, Geordie. Hi. It's a very small number of people. You know, in criminology, it's zero, you know. and so I guess I reconcile it just by, I'm still learning how to, but by having breaks, I guess. So, like, I've quit academia so many times. So most recently at the start of this year, I took unpaid leave indefinitely, and I just came back for second semester only recently. So, and that's... And I don't regret those times when I've kind of had to quit. Like, you know, the last time I quit was when I wrote that fake journal, and that was kind of therapeutic for me in a way, you know. I think the same time I gave back a DECRA, and it was the same thing. It was kind of powerful giving it away and just, you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. It's actually, you know, I measure my achievements by... you know, who I have dinner with and, you know, who a nice email from someone who I admire and respect, you know, I'll frame that shit. Yeah.
One of the responses to the book I got from Blackfellas was the quitting emails of Blackfellas going, I've just finished the book and I'm quitting next week, and I felt really bad about it. And now I think about it very differently. Part of our survival is knowing when to walk from the violence of colonial institutions. And I'm so glad now that there are people who are walking sooner than what my husband did. So they won't have to walk that same journey. I'm interested to open up in terms of, it is a lonely place when you speak truth to power and you speak to the lies of this place and call out the delusion of what this is. And I'm wondering how you've come to think now about what solidarity means, what it feels like, what it looks like, both from within our own community as well as more broadly. What is solidarity in those moments? How did you come to understand solidarity in a proper way in those moments where you were cast as the...
I guess... like, I do, you know, I do community organising, so organising Invasion Day and other protests like Black Lives Matter more recently, Black Deaths in Custody rallies... but I remember there was when Elijah Doherty's court case happened and that lad was, you know, pretty much able to walk free. We threw a protest in the city and there was this woman there who was, like, helping, but I didn't ask her for help. And I kind of got a bit wild about it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you this is my job, like, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. Anyway, she came to a meeting afterwards. We had, like, a debrief. And then she was like, oh, you know, I've done all of this organising and all of this, like, marshalling or, like, I can't remember the word that she uses, but, yeah, she, like, showed up and she now organises marshals for us, her and a friend. They organise marshalling for us for Invasion Day and other protests that we do, and I think that in that moment I didn't know that we needed the help, and also we weren't able to accept help either. Well, I was very strong-minded, particularly from people that weren't blackfellas. You know, I totally rejected the idea of non-Aboriginal people having any part of our infrastructure and organising. And it was, you know, I had to let it go. Mm. I mean, it's been really great for us because it meant that we got to learn things. We get to be able to focus on the actual the politics of our protests also, and also asking them for advice and, like, making sure our mob looked after at these protests. Mm. So, because, you know, you get out there on the 40 degree day or 30 degree day and you're protesting and you have marshals there who, you know, will probably have water, who are directing you where to go, who are talking to the police. You know, there's all of these things that they put in place so the burden on blackfellas wasn't there. And, you know, that I think that was huge moment of solidarity for me in particular, because I was always the one organising the crowds, and it's been really good to focus on the politics of the protests and all of that kind of stuff rather than, like, you know, the real logistical things around organising martial training. So it's been, yeah, I found that really deadly. And another part was when we had the Black Lives Matter protest here in Melbourne in 2020. And we had, like, lots of African mob jumping up on the stage, and then one of the sister girls that we know from down here, she jumped up on stage and grabbed one of the aunties off the stage because she was gone for too long. And, like, yep. You know, it was really good that we had, you know, someone from that community being able to jump up there and say, you know, aunt, yep. You need to jump off the stage.
No one wants that job.
Because we didn't want to tell mob, like, there's no African mob to get off either. No. Even though we'd organised it, but it's also, like, knowing the limits and who's best placed to do something. And that was a really deadly moment for us to be able to rely on the community around us for that solidarity to help us so that we can be respectful as well.
So there is a place for settlers to be ambitiously un-Australian also.
Absolutely, and settlers should be ambitiously un-Australian.
Absolutely.
It's an expectation.
I'm conscious of time, and I did say we're all going to, I didn't tell you, but in my head, we're all going to open for Q&A for anyone who wanted to have a question. So I'll just give you a moment to think about whether you have a question. I'm curious, Michaela, what words, I mean, my experience in writing a book, just navigating the editorial process, the way in which black voices get policed and regulated, even when you come with your own story. I'm curious what advice you would give to the sovereign storyteller who's thinking about writing, about what they need to know in terms of holding their story, yeah, and protecting, fighting for their story.
I love this question because I actually, I had a class at Sydney Uni in 2017 with the incredible writer Beth Yap. She's a Malaysian-Australian writer, and she gave us, and she was looking at me a lot because I think I was the only Aboriginal student in the class, and she was looking at me and she said, they're going to try and change your voice. Mm. They're going to try, but they need you, they need your story way more than you need them. You can shop your stuff around. And I just always took that on. And not long after that, I'd had an essay I'd published on a blog years ago, and it got picked up. and they wanted to republish it, and they said, oh, we'll just do a couple of edits. And this was the first time I was going to be published somewhere else, you know, and edited. And they absolutely butchered my voice, and I read it, and they changed everything around, and they, you know, and the piece is supposed to be spoken. There's a music and a rhythm to it, and there's a fiery kind of delivery, and they just butchered it. And I had Beth's voice in my head telling me to not do it. And I wrote to them. I said, I don't want this published under my name. It's not my voice. And the main editor came on board, and she said, oh, no, you're right, that was an intern. No, look, you published it as is. So, and I was just so empowered by that. And that came from a writer who has been publishing in this country since the 90s, and she was always treated as the ethnic writer, the Asian writer and the exotic writer. And so she just really knew. And from that, and from having my work in other anthologies and journals, and working with a variety of editors, some who are just so hands-off, it's like they're scared to touch my writing out of fear of offending me, but some who are just so meddly and, you know, changing, you know, Aboriginal English words and things like that to their proper structure.
Oh, dear.
You know, so with all that in mind, when I was editing this anthology, I had never edited other people before, but I had this experience of my own with good editors and not so good editors, but I've also got 2 decades experience working in Aboriginal education and working with students and, you know, guiding them to be better writers and better thinkers, but being very gentle. So I drew on those, and when I put the call for submissions out, I actually stipulated in it that I won't make your voice try and sound white, because I knew that I would be getting stories from writers who'd never published before, and I wanted their experience here to be a really positive experience. I wanted them to enjoy this so they can go out and do it again, because I know there have been writers who have just been so stung and they haven't wanted to do it anymore, and that's how we get shut out of the literary industry. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to be positive, and it was lovely. Some of the writers who I didn't know before this process, we've become friends, and through that relationship of editing and talking about things and not, you know, not being pushy but asking questions about where they want to go with it. I loved it. I hope they did too. I've had nice feedback, and I'd absolutely do it again. Yeah.
Solid. Now, I might just open up to see if we have any questions from the audience. Yes, thank you. We've got one up front. Do you have a mic? We probably have time for a couple of quick questions.
Thank you, and thank you all of you. How fantastic to have you 4 powerhouses on the one stage. My question is for Amanda and for Chelsea. You mentioned the difficulties of being muzzled in a situation where you've got so much to say. Once that process is over, will you be able to share a lot more? Like, is it about the process, or is this, in this particular situation, kind of more of a permanent thing?
Do you want to go?
Oh, in terms of the work we're currently working on? We're waiting to see whether or not the work will even see the light of day. So if you're watching the news, you can see what's happening right now, having done that work. But there's also limitations around what... It's contested. And I think in this place, every attempt to tell the truth about the violence of this place is contested. And that represents a form of violence in and of itself, because... As black nerds, we'd go, well, it's the evidence base, just let's do the analysis. and still have this idea that you can do that. And it's like, oh no, the rules are suddenly different.
Yeah.
And they get to control and make the decisions about all of that.
Yeah, I mean, but I've done a few of these, and I've learnt now that I have to, when they'll get you to do some agreement, and I'll always say, I agree with everything except for clause 16. We want to keep the IP, and we want to retain the right to publish this, because they also love to kind of, shred these documents or file them away. So it'll be interesting to see. Yeah.
I've had another criminal inquiry where I was commissioned to write a report, and then it just wasn't taken into evidence. No question. It just was just not put into evidence, even though they commissioned me to do it. So it's a thing with most of these criminal inquiries, in terms of the terms of reference and the scope in which they narrow when suddenly the evidence becomes available or obvious.
protecting their power.
I can say that it is on the public record that it's Rolf's lawyer, legal team that have been fighting this, and that they've been coroner's court. You can see the issues list of which is a slightly more broad than the standard coronial inquest. However, they've left it to the last minute of the 11th hour of literally 4:10. You can see the Guardian's. And ABC have a few articles about what's happened there, and they went for the jugular, and even now saying that the coroner has to, they're saying that she might have disqualified herself by seeing something. Anyway, it's very complicated. Have a read and find some way to get this stuff and let it see the light of day.
Absolutely. we have a couple more questions. I might just come on to the front and then we'll come to the back, yeah? I think we'll sneak in just... a little bit over time. Reclaiming our time.
Thank you so much for your presentations. And I'm really wondering if you could comment on what you think the impact of a successful referendum might be on the un-Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, and whether or not that might, how that might change its status and place in this place.
Does someone want to take that question? I mean, I'm team fuck hope, just to be clear. I don't believe in progress, irrespective of the outcome. But anyone want to comment on...
I'm sorry, I really don't want to comment on it.
Yeah.
I don't know,
there's been a lot of ugly discussion.
It's flogging a dead horse, you know.
And it's, I personally am not interested in it. I don't think it's going to do much, but that's it.
Cool.
And I don't feel comfortable commenting just because, I'm here on Wurundjeri country as an uninvited guest, and out of respect for the Koori community here that have, the Yurok Commission and... Treaty Assembly, I just wouldn't be appropriate for me as a UN woman to kind of... take up space right now.
I would, but I thought you were talking about voice stuff.
In the referendum?
Yeah. I'm not.
Thank you. We might just go to the last question at the back, if that's okay. We'll just give you the mic.
Ali Cobby
behind you.
Hey,
Ali.
Just as a Yankantara woman and the concern for community. Is there ever a time frame about the suppressions? Will there be a time when they can't be hidden?
This is why I go to hospital. Yeah.
Yeah, I just like always trying to find their own legal fuckability.
Yeah.
Like there's a time, like, right, well, you know...
That's why I had the somber starting about the... It pissed me off that Prince Philip was hogging the news at the 30-year Rikadik thing, was because in that same week there was the release of the coroner's finding into the death of... I can't remember the young gentleman's name, but there was a suppression order on the publication of anything relating to the use of tasers. It makes me really, the reporting on that particular inquest was horrendous. It focused just on health issues. You don't hear anything about tasers, and it's just a matter of, and here in the state of Victoria, they recently spent so much money on tasers, and it's only a matter of time before it's a... extreme danger, particularly for the Aboriginal community here, particularly for homeless and other communities here. And it's one of the reasons why media reporting is so bad. But I think that's my next challenge, I guess, is figuring out ways to publish this creatively, figuring out ways to leak this ethically, figuring out ways of getting it out there by other or any means necessary. Yeah.
Just thank you all for your brave work.
Thank you.
Sorry, I don't have a good response. Sorry.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank you for joining us this morning. That's a great place to end on, but I want to just leave a final word from each of you. We know that you are ambitiously un-Australian. I want you to, I guess in one word, sum up, what are you ambitious about, if it's not Australian?
Well, after this week and relaxing, it's been really busy. I'm ambitiously going to stop trying to hustle and work so much, and I've got a holiday planned, and I know that goes against the kind of Australian colonial capital hustle machine, but that's what I'm going to be ambitious about.
Solid. Yep. Enjoy it.
I'm ambitious about exposing the racial violence of policing.
Thank you.
I just want to cook more.
Yeah. Dunning can cook. Dunning can cook.
What about yourself?
What do you want? What are you doing, Chelsea?
What am I ambitious about? I'm ambitious about leaving the academy in a few years. All right. Second career. Watch your space.
As an award-winning writer.
Apparently. Look, thank you so much again for joining us this morning, and enjoy your Writers' Festival.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers' Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.